Thanks. My name's Alec. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Very grateful to be here. My sobriety date is December 23rd, 1996. I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Becoming an alcoholic was really easy for me. It took no effort whatsoever. But becoming a member of Alcoholics Anonymous took a lot, and it's required a lot for me to stay here and remain a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I think it's important that I say both. And it took a little bit of work for me to get here. Billy asked me to speak last year, and there were some bumps along the road, some health problems, and some scheduling conflicts. And I'm really glad to be here, and I'm really pleased to be at an enthusiastic AA meeting. And I will tell you this: somewhere along the line, I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how it happened. I didn't come here to fall in love with AA, but it happened. So I'll talk to you. I have a home group. I have a sponsor, and I've had those things since very early in my sobriety. I've not been sober since my first AA meeting, but I've been sober since I got a sponsor and a home group. So draw what conclusions you like from that, but I think it's important to share that with people. I'll tell you in a brief way. Let me get my watch off here. I'll talk to you a little bit about my drinking, and I want to try and get a lot of time left to talk about sobriety and to talk about the path that we're on together. I grew up in a small town in New England called Cape Elizabeth, Maine, a beautiful little town on the water. There's if you're a guy who craves excitement, there's not much to do there. I had to get out of there fast. I mean, you know, people go there to vacation and say, wouldn't this be a nice place to live? And, man, I was out of there as soon as, I think, 2 weeks after high school, man, I was gone. I come from a great family. There are no alcoholics in my immediate family, but they're there in the wings, right? You know, I have some, my dad grew up in an alcoholic house, and he loves Alcoholics Anonymous for what it's done for me, you know, because he knows what his childhood was like, and, you know, and he saw what alcoholism does, you know, and he has a brother. I usually forget this. I have an uncle, right? He's a nice guy, lives in out west. And then I sometimes forget I have two uncles, but I forget because I have an alcoholic uncle who has more or less disappeared since I was very young. And this is the case with, as you know, with many alcoholics. He has almost no connection to the family whatsoever. There was a period where every few years he'd ask for money, you know, and then disappear again. And that's the natural state of an alcoholic, right? You know, I mean, that's... What can a family do with an alcoholic? Well, just kind of forget about him, you know, and let him go. And that's the kind of drinking that I started out heading towards. So there is some alcoholism, you know. But at the time I started drinking, I'd never seen anybody drunk. I mean, I think I'd seen, I was joking about this, didn't I? I saw cartoons where people are drinking. When I was a little kid, they'd have people who are drunk, and they're always hiccuping, right? You know, and that's how you know in the cartoons that somebody is drunk, because they're hiccuping. And I don't know. I've made a lot of bizarre noises under the influence of alcohol, but I don't think alcohol ever gave me a case of the hiccups. That's probably the one symptom that I never had. So I started out as a teenager, you know, and I thought I'd try drinking. I wanted to know what it felt like to be drunk. And, you know, I was a That's it. I try, you know, I wasn't after social drinking. I didn't want to learn how to pair a wine with my steak. You know, I didn't want any of that. I wanted to be drunk. I wanted to be good and drunk. And so me and my friend Jeff got together in a little town like that. You know, you go, you sneak down to the beach and you drink at night. So we got together, and he had found cigarettes for us, you know, and so he found the cigarettes, and it was my job to get the booze, and I smuggled booze out of the house. I used little hotel shampoo bottles, and I can remember getting packed for the night, and I had all the adrenaline, and I was probably 12 or 13, and I knew I was dealing in the world of big-time trouble, and I'm dumping out the shampoo, and I'm rinsing it out, and going and getting some booze from my mother's liquor cabinet, and I did a terrible job of rinsing out the shampoo bottle. And I didn't know that until we were down on the beach, and we were trying so hard to drink this gin and pert, you know, and it's bubbling, and it's so that bitter soapy. If you ever had to wash your mouth out with soap, which I imagine many of you had to do, you know the feeling, and we could not get enough of that stuff down. If you've, incidentally, if you've ever drank gin and shampoo, that's not normal drinking, you know. That's not on the menu anywhere, anywhere. No one in their right mind would try that, you know, and I stand before you tonight. So Jeff and I, we knew we had to try again, and I grew up, you know, my parents divorced real young, and I grew up in my mom's house, and she traveled for work. And as a consequence, I got the house to myself quite a lot. And my mother had a reasonable liquor cabinet. She's a non-alcoholic, almost a non-drinker, and so I had a great selection. I mean, I can guarantee you there are bottles in my mother's liquor cabinet that I stole from in 1994 that are just sitting there now. And so, you know, Jeff and I got to steal some of my mom's booze, and we got rip-roaring, falling down drunk, and my friend Jeff is not an alcoholic, and he had a fun afternoon, and that's what he had. I had a spiritual awakening. I had a radical shift in values. I had a personality change as a result of that afternoon. And I didn't become what I turned into that afternoon. But whatever path I was on, I changed direction. I started pointing towards what I was to become. I believe if there's a line that we cross over into alcoholism, I crossed it from that very first time. I mean, I look at my reaction to alcohol, and from the very beginning, I've never experienced controlled drinking and moderate drinking. I've never embraced moderation, you know. I've never been uncomfortable with the feeling that the drinking gave me. It wasn't until several months in sobriety that I learned this, and if you're new, hold on to your chair. People who aren't alcoholic don't enjoy the feeling of being intoxicated. It's uncomfortable to them. It's unpleasant, right? Try and wrap your mind around that one. When somebody told me that, I said, no, get out of here. You're kidding. They don't like it. They do not like it. They will go to lengths to avoid feeling that way. You know, they will leave a party, you know, without police assistance. So here I am. I'm a kid, and my drinking seems perfectly normal to me. My mother's traveling. I'm in high school. I'm driving to school. I'm coming home. I'm fixing myself dinner. I'm making some cocktails. I'm doing some homework, maybe. And I'm thinking that I've really got my act together. I'm feeling like a grown-up, you know. It never occurred to me that I was drinking by myself. And if it had, it never would have occurred to me that drinking by myself was abnormal. I mean, why not, right? What is it about non-alcoholics that keeps them from drinking in the morning? Is it like a muscle that they flex, you know? Is it emotional? I mean, why don't they do it, you know? I don't understand. Whatever it is that limits consumption of alcohol, I don't have it. And in so many words, my condition is described in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I start drinking, I have little or no control over the amount I take. And I exhibited that from the very beginning. You know, the symptoms of my alcoholism weren't clear from day one, but that one was. But I was having fun. I really was. I mean, I was having the time of my life. I started out as a really nerdy kid. I was not cool. I was bad at sports and good at math. You figure it out. You know, that's never been cool. I don't care how old you are and what generation you come from. That's never been a formula for success. I was good at spelling. You know how much that helps you with the ladies? None. But when I started drinking, I got in with the drinking crowd. I don't think they were alcoholics, but they were, you know, they were the cool kids. And I was just speaking last night at a young people's conference, and I got sober when I was 19. I'm 34 now, and I'm almost starting to have to explain my drinking to the younger crowd. You know, like, I drank before cell phones, and which is shocking to some people, but what that means is that when you didn't know where the party was, if you didn't know by about 6 o'clock on Friday, you were just getting in your car and driving. I mean, you couldn't call someone and ask where people were. You just had to drive until you found them, you know. And so I'm, you know, we're drinking in the woods, and we're, you know, this is Maine, and people have hunting cabins and ski cabins, and we're going there, you know, and having parties there. And then Monday we're back at school, and we're laughing and high-fiving and telling some war stories, you know, and I'm feeling a part of the fellowship of booze. And I'll tell you, you know, if I could just stay there, I'd be doing it now, you know. I'd be doing it tonight. But my understanding of this condition is that it's progressive in nature, you know, and I had to give up more and more to continue to drink in the way that I wanted. So that was it. So things were fun, but it was starting to get abnormal. I mean, I knew from the very beginning that I could not tell the truth about my drinking, and that I had to lie, you know, to cover up my drinking. Nobody explained that to me. I just knew it. And every once in a while I'll get a drinking dream, you know. And I don't know about you, but when I get drinking dreams, if I'm drinking, I'm lying about it in the dream. They go hand in hand for me, you know. And so it's a little. You know, I think that's why we put so much stock on honesty in Alcoholics Anonymous and telling each other the truth about ourselves. And for me, dishonesty just goes hand in hand with that drinking as a way of life. I'll move quickly. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous very early. I was introduced to AA my senior year of high school. The guys that I drank with, we were all drunks. We were all real bad drunks. And just through sheer luck, everybody but me was getting in trouble. And I can't explain it other than just it was luck. You know, I'd leave a party, and I'd wobble my way home, and I'd park the car, and I'd sleep it off, and I'd find out the next day that my friend had flipped a car, and they'd pulled him out with the jaws of life and locked him up, or he was, you know, guys are in hospital beds, handcuffed, and that kind of thing. And I'm looking at them, and I'm saying, wow, thank God I'm not that bad, right? You know, you know how we are, you know, and the guys I was drinking with were spending nights in jail and going to detoxes and going to rehabs and being sentenced to AA. And none of them are staying sober, but we're talking about it, you know, and we're talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And if just in case you're wondering, driving around drinking, talking about AA and how not to go there is, that's Loserville. You know, that is real loser drinking, and that's what we were doing. And so I'm hearing about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm thinking about what my father's told me about his parents and about, Bill Wilson says it, the warning of his family, ominous warning, which I failed to heed. That's my story. You know, I wouldn't have phrased it like that, but ominous warning that I failed to heed. And so I'm 18 years old, and I'm trying not to end up in AA, right? The last year of my drinking, I put a lot of effort into not going to Alcoholics Anonymous, which should be one of the 20 questions, you know. How hard have you tried to not end up in AA? I mean, that's a bad sign. The story of my first meeting goes like this. I was in Maine. A friend of mine had gone off to the University of Vermont. And he invited me to a party, and he said, we're going to throw a wild party. I want you to be there. We're going to get, he was telling me about these exotic drugs that I'd never even heard of, and I drove across the White Mountains of New Hampshire in my crappy high schooler car through a snowstorm to get to Vermont. And when I got there, he said, I'm glad you're here, Alec, but I need to tell you something, which is never a good way to start a conversation. And he said, I've actually stopped drinking, and we're actually not going to a party tonight, and you're actually going to be staying with me in my substance-free dorm. And he says, I've found out that I'm an alcoholic, and I'm in AA, and I think you might have a problem. Would you like to go to an AA meeting? Right. Which is a great way to end a friendship, as far as I'm concerned. And if it hadn't been snowing, I would have turned around. But he invited me to my first AA meeting, and I went. And I tell that story in a joking way, but at that point I knew something was wrong. I mean, he was not far off the mark. He knew me. He knew how I drank, and there was something going on. And what's interesting is I think I could have drank for years before I would have looked for help. But AA came to me, right? And AA came into my life in the form of probably the one person that could have brought this message to me. And it was a guy that I drank with. He was extremely credible to me, talking about his drinking. And what our book says reflects my experience, which is that an ex-problem drinker who has found this solution and is properly armed with the facts about himself can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. And I knew he was telling the truth. I knew he was, you know. And that's how I got to AA at an early age. Here's what he told me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think he knew that I wasn't really ready, but he gave me the real basics, right? And I there have been times when I've passed this on to newcomers. The real basics that he gave me was how to find AA, right? Look them up in the phone book. You can call. And what he taught me about AA was it doesn't cost anything. They don't need you to sign up. They don't ask who you are. You don't have to share. They have free coffee, and you don't have to be sober to go there, right? And I think that sums it up pretty nicely for somebody who's not quite sure if they're going to come or go. Um, And he taught me how to find, he taught me about an AA meeting in my hometown that I could catch. It was every weekday. It was a men's noon meeting. And he planted a seed there. And for the over the course of the next year, I went to that meeting several times. And I did just what he said. I just, you know, I came in quietly, didn't introduce myself to too many people. And I received a message by doing that. And I, the message that I received came in this form. Every time I went to that meeting, most of the faces there were the same. And most of the faces there were smiling. And through the haze of my drinking, that made a very strong impression on me because I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous was a place that people could go to stop drinking. I didn't know if it would work for me. I didn't know if I was really interested in what they had to offer, but I knew that every day in that room, in that church basement, there were dozens of men who were not drinking together. And they were having a pretty good time, you know. And I went off to college. I picked a school where I could drink. You know, I learned actually when you go visit colleges, they like to get you drunk. You know, it's kind of a good morale thing, you know, to try and get the high school kids drunk. I visited 22 colleges, you know, highly selective. One of them was Mount Holyoke, which is a women's school, you know. But, you know, I wanted to be thorough in my search. I picked the school with the worst smelling dorms. And that was it, you know. That was my criteria. We went on a Sunday morning and, oh, it reeked in there. You know, you knew something had been going on Saturday night there. So I went off to college. And I went off to college and I brought a big book with me. I had gone, my friend had given me a big book. And so, little warning sign here. I went to college with the book Alcoholics Anonymous in case I turned into an alcoholic, right? Not a good sign, right? This is not a good sign. I had it hidden on my bookshelf. I didn't want people to know. And that just tells me that I knew, in the back of my mind, I knew, you know, that I was seeing the hopelessness in my life. You know, I had started making some big sacrifices to allow my drinking to continue. I loved college. There was a ton of drinking, and somebody else was paying for it all. It was a dream come true, and I was not going to last very long. I mean, my first semester, I drank, you know, a wino would have diagnosed me as an alcoholic. I drank every opportunity that I had. And, you know, it was like gasoline on a fire for me. And I truly loved being there. I loved the college experience, and I knew that it wasn't going to last. I wasn't going to make it, you know. The grades were going to come home, and everybody gets a break their first semester, but after that, you know, they expect you to be serious, and I was completely incapable of it. I was incapable of showing up for anything at that point in my life. And I can remember the moment when that became clear to me, when I really accepted that, you know, it was going to come down to continuing my education or continuing to drink, and that I was going to continue to drink, and I was going to be okay with that, you know, which was really sad to me. And at that time, I was starting to look at the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I was starting to reach out for help, and I called AA, and I called AA and asked where I could find an AA meeting, and I got somebody from the intergroup office. And they went through their meeting list, and they found one near me, and I went there, and it was unfortunate, but they had bad information. The meeting hadn't been there for a long time, and the lights were off, and the door was locked. And I crawled back inside a bottle. I mean, my window of willingness was so small, and that was it. And I couldn't try. I mean, I couldn't make it another day, you know. And so now, in my sobriety, I do a lot of work for our intergroup office, and part of that reason is because of my experience. You know, it's very important to me that our meeting list, and we have almost 2,000 meetings in the Washington, D.C. meeting list, and I try very hard to make sure that that's current. And no one person can do it all, but, you know, we have a committee now. When people call the office and say, hey, I tried to find a meeting and it wasn't there, we have a group of people who will go to that location and try and find the meeting, and if it's not there, it gets yanked. You know, that's very important to me because I know, you know, that my sobriety there was a matter of seconds and inches, and it fell on the other side of the line, and I went back to drinking. So I think that's a really important thing that we do, is making sure that we have good information. And that's just something that I try and do in AA. I'm not on a soapbox about it, but it's just something that I can do to make sure that the hand of help is there. So I'm I come home, it's Christmas break. I told you my sobriety date is December 23rd, 1996. It's a horrible time to stop drinking. It's 2 days before Christmas. Usually, you know, I get some money for Christmas, and there's Christmas parties, and then there's New Year's, and, you know, you're... But that was it. I was done, you know. It came time for me to get sober. That's the explanation. I didn't plan it. I came home and met some of my buddies. We drank on the railroad tracks behind the Rite Aid and you know, told war stories. And I came home and I drank some cough syrup from my mother's medicine cabinet. I mean, that's how it ended. That was my last drink, some cough syrup. You know, I'd looted, you know, whatever pills had been in there, you know, previously, and that was all that was left. And that was to be my last drink. And, you know, I was, at that point, I was an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, I think, you know. And some of the circumstances were pretty good, you know, in that I had a place to stay and my family hadn't thrown me out yet. But, you know, I was on the path to losing the things that were important to me. So the next day, I went to that AA meeting, and I wasn't sober. I don't know if I could have gone there sober. I don't know. I don't know if I would have had the courage to do it, you know, but I was just all fuzzy, and I just sat in a meeting, and the room wobbled left and right, and I listened to guys, and they were talking about Christmas and family and how stressed out they were, and I think, you know, a lot of AA meetings around Christmas time, people are talking about that. And that was to be my sobriety. That was to be where it began. I went back to my school, and I went back to a heavy drinking environment, and the one thing that happened right away was I saw a guy my age, and I asked him to be my sponsor. First thing I did, and that's kind of how I started the conversation, which is a little foolish, actually. I didn't ask him if he was sober. You know, I didn't ask him if he knew much about AA. You know, he turned out to be pretty new himself. I mean, he was within a couple months of me. And we stayed sober together, and we felt like the only two people in AA in the universe. I mean, we felt like Bill and Bob making it up. I mean, we had the book. I mean, that's what we had. And there were meetings in town, but neither of us were particularly plugged in. We didn't know much about the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that point, I was a meeting attender. So I have experience in AA. I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been a meeting attender. And the results of those two things are very different, you know. And I prefer to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And we were going to one meeting a week. Sometimes we'd forget. When you go to one meeting a week, it's hard to remember, you know. When it's hard to get in the habit of going to the meeting. And I did a lot of crazy things. And I was surrounded by drinking. I don't know. I can't explain it. And all I can say is that now and in my sobriety, I encounter some guys who are in the same situation from time to time. Guys that get sober young, and maybe they're living in a college campus, or they're living in a frat house. You know, they're living in a war zone as far as I'm concerned. And what I say to them is I try and tell them the truth about myself. And what I say is it's possible to stay sober in that kind of environment, but it's also very, very easy to drink. You know, and within a short period of time, I don't know. I took a job. This was in upstate New York. I took a job in the D.C. area, and I went from small town AA to big city AA, and I started finding really big, enthusiastic AA meetings, and I transferred to the University of Maryland, and I moved in with a bunch of guys in the program, and, you know, I got a sponsor, and I made that jump from being a meeting attender to being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started tagging along with my sponsor, and something funny happened pretty early on is that I started to respect a couple of the men in AA, you know, and when I was pretty gun-shy when I first came to AA. I mean, there was a lot about the program that was suspect to me, but there were a few guys here and there that really seemed like their lives were together, and they weren't, you know, they weren't AA goofballs, they weren't, you know, I mean... They just seemed like the kind of guys that I enjoyed being with, but they also seemed like their lives were really together. And they were, you know, my life was kind of a mess all over the place. And I think once they earned my respect, they had me. You know, I started being willing to follow these guys around and do what they did. You know, and I want, as we say, I wanted what they had. You know, and. I got a sponsor. My previous sponsor, we'd made it up as we went along. We read the book, and we tried to figure out what it was talking about. But I got a sponsor who is experienced in the steps and experienced in bringing another alcoholic through the steps. And my sobriety really took off. You know, we looked at that first step. I started having these amazing revelations about my drinking. That was the period when I started looking back and realizing that I'd never been interested in controlled drinking, that I'd always gone for immediate blotto, you know, and the results of my life were explaining the unmanageability portion, right? That I was having trouble managing my life. And I got stuck when I got to the second step. I'll tell you, I'll have to backtrack a little bit. In my first AA meeting, the first meeting that I went to, they had the steps up on the wall. And I started reading through, and I saw the first step, and I saw powerless. And I thought, well, there you go. That makes perfect sense. I'm powerless over alcohol. I understood that. And I got to the second step, and I saw a power, came to believe that a power greater than myself. And if you notice, power is capital P, right? I mean, and I saw that, and my hopes were destroyed. I thought, okay, oh, I know what this is. Oh, it's one of those kind of things, right? You know, and then my suspicions were confirmed, because in the third step, it talks about God. And I was really upset. I thought, you know, I had whatever glimmer of hope I had on seeing the first step was extinguished, because I thought, this will never work for me. I'm not a religious person. I didn't grow up in a religious background, and you know, and that's what you people, you're just some of them, right? Some of those religious people. So when I got serious about doing the steps, I would talk to my sponsor and I would say, I'm really going to have a problem with this. And he didn't seem concerned at all about the problems that I was expecting to have with the second and third step. You know, and he told me a little bit about his story. And my sponsor's background was very different from mine. He'd been raised in an extremely religious household. And he started explaining the problems that he had with God. And his problems were legitimate. Like, he, you know, and I thought, man, I don't really, you know, you've got a reason to not like this. I just kind of don't like it in general because it doesn't seem cool. We started looking for a power that would work for me. And my personal belief now is that the second step is one size fits all. And we come in through this door with a range of experiences, with a range of backgrounds. Of some of us are open-minded and some of us are really closed-minded, and some of us have a great faith and some of us have a great religious knowledge and some of us have nothing but ignorance and antagonism. And I think for all those people, it's possible to find a way to accommodate yourself in the second step, to find a power that's sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And in Appendix 2 in our book, it clarifies that. It talks about finding a personality change. That's what they're talking about. I thought people in AA wanted me to believe something. Maybe they wanted me to believe what they believed. No, they wanted me to find a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. You know, and I like to tell guys when we start going through the steps, I hope you're interested in a personality change, because that's all we have here. I hope you're interested in that. You know, I can't promise you anything besides that. But if you're serious about these steps, you will experience a personality change. I know I have. Right? I'm not the same person that came through the door today. That, you know, that came through the door. So my sponsor gave me the second step as a homework assignment. He said, I want you to go out there and find a power greater than yourself. And I suggest you find some people that you respect in AA and ask them what they do. And I learned something. When you are sincerely interested in learning from the experience of others, they will open up their lives like an open book, right? You know, and I found, I started with one or two people. I started with some old timers, and I told them what was going on, and I said, I'm having a lot of trouble with this. Can you kind of tell me what you have and how you got that? And I loved doing that. I had some of the most amazing conversations, and I learned a lot. And I think what I learned is that, you know, there are as many different higher powers as there are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And some stuff I learned I loved, and I said, man, I hope someday I have a higher power like that. Some stuff I heard, and it was clear it wasn't going to fit me. Some stuff seemed like it wasn't for me, and it would take years before it would be something that I would incorporate into my own beliefs, right? I gobbled it up. I read it. We have a book called Came to Believe, and I went through that, and it's a whole bunch of different people's experiences with that. And so what happened to me is I had a spiritual awakening of the educational variety, right? You know, I've never had a powerful spiritual experience. I was at a step study once, and we did a, it was a very large crowd, and we did a show of hands of And the question was, if you've done, was how many people, if, and you don't have to do this, but, you know, it was how many people have done a thorough fourth and fifth step, and how many of those people had a powerful spiritual experience as a result of that. And we did a show of hands. It was 150 people maybe, and about 10% of the people had a powerful, significant spiritual experience as a result of doing the fourth and fifth step, which is really cool, right? What that tells me is the other 90% of those people were able to stay sober, that a powerful spiritual experience is not necessary, a flash of light type of thing, you know. But what worked for me was a spiritual awakening, that over time I became willing to have an open mind towards some of these things. So without going into it too much, I'll tell you what the second step is like for me today. I've read a lot of books. Most of them have nothing to do with AA. I've done what the book said, which is be quick to see where religious people are right. And I'll tell you what I believe. And this is my belief, and I'll share it with you, and this is my personal belief. I believe that if I do what the people in AA do today, I don't have to drink today. And that's about as deep as my knowledge goes. That's my theology, right? You know? And most everybody in AA probably has a better religious background than me and an understanding. And that's my understanding. But you know what? It's extremely effective. You know, and the book talks about, you know, upon having an open mind, an extremely effective structure can be built. You know, and that I should not, though I may resist some of these spiritual terms, I shouldn't resist asking myself what they mean to me. And so that's what it's been. And that's the power that I was looking for. And that's how I did the second step. And you know what? That search has turned into something that's really, really one of my favorite parts of sobriety. And I've made a lot of friends by talking to people, you know. And I told my sponsor, I said, you know, when I'm helping guys through the steps, I'm supposed to share this stuff, but I feel like an ignorant person, you know, because I don't. There are people who stand at the podium and talk about a relationship with God, and it's very moving. And I could probably stand up here and lie to you and tell you I have a great relationship with God, but it's not the truth, you know. And so I would say to my sponsor, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm just kind of faking it. And he said, as long as you're telling the truth, that's okay. If you tell people the truth about your experience, you'll be able to help them. And so so I talk about the struggles that I've had. And usually I end up getting people who talk to me after the meeting and say, man, I'm going through something like that. You know, I really didn't like AA. AA really scared me. I thought it was a religious program, or, you know, I just, they have trouble with it, you know, and we're able to speak honestly to each other. I moved on to do the third step, and my sponsor told me to memorize the third step prayer, and I started praying the third step prayer. And I made a decision to go on with the steps, you know, and I am a person now. I say the third step prayer more or less on a daily basis. I've changed the words around because the book says the wording is optional. First, I got rid of the thee and thou, right? The book says, God, I offer myself to thee. Doesn't work for me, so, you know. And I have a short form of the third step prayer that I made up recently, and I say it all the time, and I say, God, put me to work, you know. Put me to work, show me the way, and give me the tools. And I believe, you know, if I go to my boss and I say, put me to work, I got some free time, you know, my boss will find something for me to do. And I think when I sincerely ask God to put me to work, you know, and I say, sometimes I say, make it obvious, you know, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do, but I'm ready for duty. Show me who needs help, right? And, they come in my path. And that's my third step prayer. And that's what I do on a daily basis, right? You know, that's how I start my day. And I never know what it's going to bring. It helps if I go out of my way to call a few people and ask what's going on with them. You know, I can do that much. But really, I went on with the steps. My sponsor, as I said, was experienced in working the steps. He was very familiar with the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had me take the actions that are listed in the book. I made some columns where I wrote down my resentments. I wrote down my fears. I had a lot of fears. I was a person who was really trapped by fear. You know, and I looked at, and I wrote down some of my harms, and I looked at my sex conduct and where I'd been selfish with that. And we made an appointment to go over those things, and we did what the fifth step says. And the fifth step says we pocket our pride and we go to it. And that's, you know, and that's what I did. I sat there in my sponsor's bedroom and read through all this stuff. And he helped me see some situations where I wasn't sure where I was wrong. you know, where I wasn't sure where I'd been selfish and self-seeking and frightened. And there are some promises in our book that come after the fifth step, and they started coming true for me. Here's what I'll say about the fifth step. When I started drinking, the path that I was on in life changed just a little bit, and I started going in a really new direction. When I did a complete and thorough fifth step with my sponsor, the same thing happened. You know, my life started to go in a different direction, and it wasn't noticeable at first. But when I look back, I can trace a lot of things in my life back to that day, you know, where I was able to find an open mind where I'd had a really closed mind before. And I got some of those promises that talk about I can be alone at perfect peace and ease. I mean, my head was a poison factory for a long time in sobriety. And I can tell you this, there's a lot of days where, you know, I can be alone without making plans to rob a bank. You know, I can, you know, I can just sit and watch the breeze in the trees, you know, and you know, there's times when I shouldn't be alone still, or I shouldn't be without adult supervision. So because of this process of getting all this stuff out, there's times where I can be alone at perfect peace and ease. And I can look the world in the eye. And that was a big thing for me, you know. And that was a huge freedom for me to not have to look at my shoes all the time. One of my favorite prayers in there is the fear prayer. And I had a long list of fears. Man, I had so many. When I started writing them down, I didn't realize how many there were until I started getting them down on paper. And the fear prayer that we do, we look at these fears and why we have them, and it's because self-reliance fails me. It's because I'm unable to rely on God. And so the fear prayer is, please remove this fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And my sponsor had me go through the list, and for each and every fear, he would have me say that prayer, God, please remove my fear of dying and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. Please remove my fear of drinking again and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. Please remove my fear of something awful happening to my family. You know, please remove my fear of pretty girls so that I can ask them out on a date someday and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. You know, and I went through all that stuff. And the book says we commence to outgrow fear. I wanted it to say our fears disappeared in the next half hour, but that's not what it says. It says I commence to outgrow fear. So my report to you is, none of those fears have left me entirely, but none of them push me around like they used to. I don't live as a prisoner of fear like I used to. And it went back to that day. And I still use that prayer. I go through times where I'm just terrified, you know, and I use that prayer. Please remove this fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. Note that that's different from God change this situation right now. It's remove my fear, because I'm the one that has to change. And I use that prayer a lot. And it's been great, you know, it's been a really important tool for me. When we uncovered a lot of this stuff in the fourth and fifth step, it became clear to me that a lot of things had to change. And so that was the sixth and seventh step stuff, and I have two different opinions about the sixth and seventh step. And if you're alcoholic, you can have two contradictory opinions at the same time, you know. I'm on the one hand, I'm of the opinion that God is removing my character defects as he sees fit, right? And it's God's business to decide what and when goes away. On the other hand, I know that the majority of the effort in my day-to-day life also goes into not acting out on these defects, you know. And I think what that means is that you know, I've got a job and God's got a job, and I've got to not get those two confused. But I have to clean up my act in a lot of ways. And it really helps me to have role models in AA. And I think that's been one of the best things for me, is that I have men in Alcoholics Anonymous that I look up to. And sometimes I think, what would these guys do if I'm not sure what to do with myself? You know, I think, you know, is this really how my sponsor would behave? And so I can't say that any of my defects have been removed, but I've asked for a lot of help from God and from other people with them, you know. And my sponsor's been my sponsor for a long time, you know. It's been coming up on 12 years, and he knows a lot of the little stuff that I get into, and we joke about it. I can call him up and say I'm doing it again, you know, and there's no introduction necessary. So I put a lot of effort into that, and I think that goes hand in hand with trying to be an example of the principles. I'll talk about that in the 12th step. The 10th step became something that I did on the phone with my sponsor. I'd talk about my day, and he would rephrase it, you know. I'd say, I'm angry, you know. He would say, you know, what happened 5 minutes before you got angry, you know, or have you eaten, that kind of thing. We started looking at my inventory. I want to make sure that I have time to talk about the amends. I wrote down an 8th step, a list of the harms that I had done, and most of the harms that I had done were limited to my family. There was one stolen car that needed to be rectified, and you know what? I thought that was going to be the big one. That was nothing. I called this guy up. You know, he was a friend of the family. I bought his car. We made a payment plan, and I made one payment. And this guy was really well-to-do. He didn't need the money, and he didn't make a big deal about it. But it was a real big thing for me. And I just called him up, and he said a check would be fine. That was it. I mean, it was a really short conversation. And so that financial one was easy. But the emotional stuff with my family took a lot longer. And I made formal amends with guidance from my sponsor. I don't live near my family. So, my family's all up in New England. I live near D.C. And so from time to time, when I was up on vacations, I would be able to pull them aside. You know, I did my amends to my dad during the Saturday morning dump run. It's something he does every Saturday. He goes to the dump, you know, and we were going to and from the dump, and I said the things that my sponsor had coached me through about how I know I'd been a disappointment to him as a son, and I didn't go into specifics because he's not the kind of guy who wants to dwell on that. He really doesn't, you know. That would cause him harm to have to go back and revisit it, you know. And so I had to ask him. I said, look, I'm not really sure what you're looking for in a son. Can you let me know? I mean, what can I do? What is it, you know, what is it that you hoped I would be? And he wanted me to be in touch with him. And so my mother had the same answer. So I went for, you know, I started calling my parents every Sunday. I would fold laundry and I'd be on the phone with them. And I'd go through my parents, my grandparents, my sister, talk to them all. My mother had another special request. She said, when you graduated high school, you were gone. You know, and it's true. 2 weeks after graduation, I was gone. I was, you know, I moved to Mississippi to take a job, and I went off to college, and I was barely home after that. And she said, I'd like you to come home for a little while. And how could I say no to that? So I cleared some time in my schedule, and I came home for a couple weeks. Not with the purpose of seeing my friends, going out and doing the things that I wanted to do, with the purpose of spending time with my mother. And I learned that noon meetings were really good for that, because I could go to a noon meeting and then I could have a long dinner with my mother and help her cook and clean up and sit at the table afterwards and maybe go, and we had a fireplace in the backyard, you know, and we'd sit out there and, you know, just talk, watch for shooting stars. I mean, it was a great, great experience. And I think the thing that meant the most to them was the consistency that I was starting to demonstrate in my life. You know, they knew that the phone was going to ring on Sunday afternoon and they were going to hear from me. And I would love to be able to do one big thing and win them over, but it turns out it's actually a lot of little things that convince people that we're on a different path. You know, it's them knowing that they can count on us. And my parents started to figure out that I wasn't in danger anymore, you know. And things started to change around in the family, and I was no longer the problem of the family, which was a shock, you know, the first time there was a problem and it wasn't me. Because there used to be meetings about me that I wasn't invited to. I don't know if you ever had that, you know, where decisions were made for me, and I was informed of the result later. And I became close to my parents in a way that I'd never been before. Our relationship wasn't restored to the way it was. It was transformed into something new and better, you know, because of what AA gave me. And, you know, and I'll tell you a couple stories that came out of that. A few years ago, I was having dinner with my mother. She was down in D.C. And she had gone through her parents had one after another had gotten sick and had passed on, and she'd had to settle their estates. And it's a real hassle if you've been through that. It's settling someone's estate is a real pain. And it had taken a lot out of her. And we were talking about that. And she said, actually, Alec, if you're okay with this, I'd like you to be the executor of my estate. I'm doing some paperwork now, and there's nothing wrong with me. But when the time comes, I'd like to know if you're willing to do that. And I was floored, because what that meant is I was going to be the responsible one in the family. I couldn't believe it. I don't know about you. You know, I was shocked. But my mother knew, and she'd been watching me, and she'd been watching how I behaved the way that you guys taught me to. And I'll tell you what she also knew. She also knew that in my AA group, there's a lawyer, and there's an accountant, and there's all those people that you need to go to for help, you know. She knew that what AA had made me, and what AA has turned me into, is the kind of guy, you know, where if I say I'm going to do something, I do it, you know. And that's how I know. When I watch guys come through the door, that's how I know they're getting better. It's when you can ask them to do something and it gets done without a reminder, that's a sign that somebody's starting to pick it up, you know, starting to get it. And so that's how it is. That means, you know, when the time comes, that's the job that I'll do for my mother. She brought me into this world, and I'll be the one to settle her affairs. And hopefully it won't be for a long, long time. But I'm absolutely willing to do that. And with my dad, you know, I can't talk to my dad without him telling me how much he loves me and how proud he is of me, you know. And it was really hard for him when I was drinking, because there wasn't much for him to be proud of. I mean, he wanted so hard to be proud of me, but I wasn't giving him much to work with, you know. And, you know, a couple years ago, he remarried a long time ago, and he decided to renew his wedding vows with my stepmother. And so we were talking about it, and he said, he asked me to be his best man in that ceremony, you know, that there's nobody closer to him in his life. There's no man that's closer to him. And I stood by his side, you know, and gave him away. I said, Dad, I'm in AA. I'm not planning your bachelor party. you know, we went through that, and, you know, what else can I talk about? I can talk about my family life. I married a woman that I met in AA. She's sober longer than me. And we had, what a year it's been. Our daughter was born 9 months ago. And I was able to, you know, my mom drove down from New England. And I was able to put my daughter into my mother's arms. You know, wow, magic. You know, and we have a family that should not be. I mean, write out my story on paper, write out my wife's story on paper, put them side by side, and then say that these people have a peaceful and a safe home. You know, there's no explanation for that. We have a family that shouldn't be, and yet we're able to live happily. And we have a great time. We really do have a ball. You know, it was a long road for us to have a kid, and there were some problems, and you know, we were at the doctor's one day, and we were, you know, my wife was pregnant, and we still had a few weeks to go, and the doctor said, there's a problem, and we're going to get that baby right now. I tried to explain to him that we weren't ready, you know, and he gave us a couple days. It was Friday. He said, you know, you've got until Sunday night, but we want you to be at the hospital Sunday night. And I'm losing my mind, because I haven't, you know, the A army descends, and we've got people putting furniture together, and they're sorting out clothes with my wife, and we have all these clothes, but we don't have any preemie clothes, and we've got people going to buy preemie clothes for us. And, you know, we got to the hospital, and it took a bunch of days, but I got to deliver my daughter. I got to catch her. I got to cut the cord, you know, and what a gift for somebody like me, for a dirtbag like me. And then a couple weeks later, my wife had a heart attack from out of the blue. You know, just when we thought we were out, we had brought this little 4.5-pound baby home, and things were looking up. And my wife had a heart attack. There was no real rhyme or reason to it. And I'm, you know, my mother's at home with the baby, and my wife's in the hospital, and I'm doing the best I can. I'm going home and helping out with mom and the baby, and I'm going to the hospital and trying to help my wife out with the paperwork. And I'm keeping it together in either place. But in the car in between, I was losing my mind, you know, and the AA army showed up again, and people cooked for us and helped us out. And there's a woman in our group who's a doctor, and she took a day off, you know, and spent the entire day sitting with us in waiting rooms and helping us to read charts and make medical decisions that neither of us were qualified to make, you know, out of the goodness of her heart. And my dad called and wanted to send flowers to my wife, and I said, nope. Here's where you're sending them. You're sending them to the doctor, you know, for what she did. And you know, and that's how it's been. And you know, being a parent has been a dream come true for me in a lot of ways. What it's really meant, though, is that, you know, I was 13 years sober when our daughter was born, and my life was really pretty smooth in sobriety. I mean, it had been a long time since I had been in desperate need of help. And I found myself in desperate need of help once again. You know, I needed all the tools that AA had taught me. And I was calling people up, and I was telling Billy, you know, I wasn't doing the usual AA, you know, how's it going? Oh, by the way, can I ask you about something? It was, you know, hey, can I talk to you right now? I'm really having a tough time. You know, what do I do? And I started, you know, and the guys that I started calling were the guys who were dads, who had experience with it, you know, and who were showing me how to get through it. And so that's, you know, I mean, that's how it's been. And I've, but what a beautiful gift, you know, that to not have to go through that alone. And what else do I want to talk about? I want to talk about the 12th step a little bit. And I want to talk about what a difference that made for me. I remember the first time somebody asked me to sponsor them. And we went to a meeting together. And I was sitting into a meeting, and the guy that I was sponsoring was right next to me. And I don't think I've ever sat with better posture and paid more attention. I wanted this guy to know that there's a right way to sit in an AA meeting, you know. And I'll tell you what, I was telling my sponsor about that, and he says, yeah, sponsoring somebody sure makes you a better sponsee, doesn't it? You know, and I started getting the magic of this program when I started giving it away. I started getting people in my life, and I'm calling my sponsor, you know, when am I going to get some good pigeons? I'm getting, like, you know, I'm getting these bottom of the barrel guys, you know. I don't think any of them have potential, you know. He was laughing at me. You know, but being able to pass this thing on has been a real gift, and I've tried. Really, one of the hardest things that I've been asked to do is this part about practicing the principles in all our affairs. And we say that, and we toss the line around, you know, but what does that really mean? I started looking. I was like, what principles? And I've been to, like, AA clubhouses where they have a list of about 1,000 principles, and which seemed okay until I went to a meeting where the Boy Scouts met, and the Boy Scouts had a list of their principles, and it was the same list. So I started wondering, what are the AA principles? I mean, there's a lot of good principles that are just part of human nature. So a friend of mine found them for me. This is my opinion. I'm going to give you my opinion, and it's from the foreword. And I think these are the principles that differentiate AA. You know, it's from talking about Bill Wilson and his acquaintance with the Oxford groups. And it says, though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford groups, he was convinced of the need for moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. And I think those principles are the foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, there's a lot of things that I do to be a good person and to be unselfish, but I think those are the fundamental requirements. I don't think I could cut out any one of those and have sobriety or peace of mind. I don't think I could sacrifice any of those. I think they're all necessary. So that's my opinion. Subject to change, you know. But I think those are the principles that it's of utmost importance for me to practice. And it's not always easy, you know. The book says, a more important demonstration lies in I'm going to misquote this, but, you know, in our homes and our work and that kind of thing. That's where this stuff becomes real, because, let's be honest, I'm on my best behavior in the meeting. I'm all smiles when I'm around you, but, you know, what do I do when the kid's screaming, you know? And I was talking about this before the meeting. Being angry doesn't work. It changes nothing. All that happens when I'm angry at the baby is you got an upset baby and an angry dad, you know? And I've had to use all the tools, you know, and I've had to, you know, the things that when I was a year sober and I was learning how to meditate and people were talking to me about the importance of breathing, I've been using that in the last year when the screaming won't stop and what am I going to do? And I go back to breathing, you know, let my shoulders drop, you know, use those tools that I learned. And knowing when to call somebody for help, you know, sometimes I need help from God and sometimes I need somebody who will answer the phone, you know, And I try to conduct myself. I don't let a lot of people know that I'm an AA, and that's for everybody to make up that decision as you will. I don't make a big deal about it where I work. I prefer generally that people don't know that I'm an AA where I work. But I try to behave so that if they do find out I'm an AA, it doesn't reflect poorly on the fellowship. And so far, I've had a few jobs in sobriety, and I've left all of them voluntarily, and people have always, you know, tried to see if I'd be willing to stick around, you know, and so I think I've I've done a pretty good job with that, you know, and I think it's getting about on towards the end, so I'll just read one little thing that I like to close with. It's my favorite passage in the book this week, subject to change, and it's something that I love about AA, and there's a lot of things that I love about AA, but it's from page 132. It's from The Family Afterward, and our book says, "So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience out of the past. But why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered and have been given the power to help others." And that's what was given to me. So I want to thank Billy for asking me to speak, and I want to thank all of you for the power that you introduced to me and the laughter that you put into my life and for allowing me to walk side by side with you on this journey. So thank you.